supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. In my practice, I often hear the reprieve, what do I tell the kids and how do we tell the kids? But mostly they're talking about how do we tell the kids about sex or how do we tell the kids that one of their parents lost their job? But what about when one parent is an active alcoholic and their behavior dominates the family environment every day or every evening? Then what do we tell the kids and how do we tell the kids? On today's show, we hope to answer that question with my guests, Carolyn Hannon Bell, Kimberly Kirby, and Tammy Granger. Carolyn Hannon Bell is a psychotherapist in South Jersey. She's written the children's book, Daddy's Disease, Helping Children Understand Alcoholism. She's here in the studio. Carolyn, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
Kimberly Kirby is the director of the Treatment Research Institute's Parents Translational Research Center. She's a senior scientist. She's also with us here in the studio. Kim, welcome.
Thank you, Dan. It's a pleasure to be here.
And we've also got Tammy Granger. She's corporate director of student assistant programs with the Karen Treatment Centers. She's a social worker. She joins us by phone from Karen. Tammy, welcome.
Good afternoon, and thanks for having me.
And we'd love to hear from you. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. If you are living with someone who's an alcoholic now, or if you grew up with alcoholism in the family, give us a call. Carolyn, let's start with you. Your book, Daddy's Disease, is what started us thinking about this show in the first place. In your story, little Tommy has a father who's alcoholic. And like many alcoholic families, Daddy gets drunk, he breaks promises, and Tommy is hurt and confused.
Yes.
So what's it like to be Tommy, and what does he need and what does he get?
Well, Tommy, like most children, thinks that whatever's going on in his family and in his world is about him, and that he is in control of other people's behavior, that he thinks that his dad reacts or behaves the way he behaves because he either loves Tommy or he doesn't love Tommy, or Tommy has disappointed him in some way or another. And he doesn't understand that when his father doesn't show up or he doesn't come to a soccer game or just behaves badly, he doesn't understand what he's done wrong or what he can do better to make it stop.
You know, I want to turn to you, Tammy. You know, like we've been talking about with Carolyn, most children are pretty grandiose. And this is pretty typical, yes? They think they can or should control parents. So how do we disabuse kids of their grandiosity?
As you mentioned, it certainly is a natural reaction to not only the confusion of addiction in the family, but many other issues. In my work, what we tend to do and what we think is really important is to help children understand addiction a little bit better. And we need to be very age-appropriate with that information. But when children begin to understand addiction as a brain disease, they can get a sense that this is not about them. This is the fact that their parent happens to not be well. And so it gives them a sense that they are not in control of that. They would not feel responsible if their parent had diabetes or cancer, and that it, in the same with addiction as a disease, they shouldn't feel responsible for that. So that's kind of, I think, a first step of really helping them understand those specifics as appropriate for the age. And then also begin to help them explore their own feelings around the issues. And with guidance from, you know, positive adults in their life, they can really get a better sense of what is accurate and what's not, that they did not cause it, and they're not responsible to cure it or control it.
Yeah, that sounds like a mantra I heard in Al-Anon over and
Absolutely.
over.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I want to turn to you, Carolyn. So how did Tommy's mom help with this?
Well, I think the main thing that she did was to address it. She didn't do like so many families do, is they try to make excuses for the alcoholic or try to brush the bad behavior under the carpet or pretend it doesn't exist or, you know, just kind of make up reasons. She took the bull by the horns and talked to Tommy about what was going on, and she did it in a way that Tommy could understand, kind of related it to different experiences that he was having so he could understand that Daddy had his behavior was because he has a disease and not because of something Tommy did.
Kim, here's one thing I worry about, is the more we ask our children to understand, the less entitled they might be to have their rage or their confusion or, you know, I mean, yeah. You know, Tommy and all the Tommies in the world, I mean, they were in fact abandoned. They were disappointed. You know, they're pissed.
Yeah. One of the things I like about Carolyn's book is that there's a point where Tommy comes home very angry and upset, and his mother respects that. She doesn't try to talk with him at the point where he's angry and upset. So in addition to many of the things that Carolyn's book models, I do think the issue of recognizing the children have a right to those feelings and allowing them to express them without getting tied up in it emotionally yourself.
You know, we talk about in the abstract about alcoholism being a family disease, and of course it is, and any disability is really a family disease. And I do want to touch on everyone in the family, but I want to start with small children, young children. Can you make any generalizations, Kim, about what happens to them?
Well, my area of research expertise isn't in the children per se, so I'm just inviting you to look at what I have to say through that lens. One of the things that we do know is that having an addicted person in the family creates a lot of disruption. There's disruption in relationships. There tends to be increased conflict, often between the parents as well. And sometimes, too, it's not just the addiction. Often addiction is co-occurring with other mental health problems.
Usually, isn't it?
Yes, usually. Very frequently, more often than not. And so it is a wide variety of things that the child is being bombarded with. And, yeah, so it can have a lot of impacts. Usually the research talks about it as externalizing problems and internalizing problems.
What do you mean?
Externalizing problems are, things that we would normally call bad behavior or disruptive behavior. So it's the child acting out. The internalizing problems are things like sadness, depression, anger, and the feelings that accompany that.
I think a lot of times, too, the child will react the same way that the mother or the father, whoever's reacting to the alcoholism, the child will often do the same thing. Sometimes if they see, for instance, it's the mother in this book who is the non-alcoholic. If they see a mother responding in kind of codependent methods, often the child will start picking up those ways of behaving. Mm-hmm. And that's when we start to see it really sometimes coming down generations of behavior in regards to alcoholism.
Hmm. We're talking with Carolyn Hannon Bell, Kimberly Kirby, and Tammy Granger, all experts in alcoholism, substance abuse. And we're talking about telling children today, about helping children understand the disease of alcoholism, and hopefully to diminish the high risk children are at for all sorts of problems. We'd love to hear from you if you are living with active alcoholism, or if you grew up in a family or growing up in a family where there's alcoholism or any other kind of substance abuse. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Tammy, having a parent who is a substance abuser brings up so many emotions for children. It's confusing. It's shameful when they go into other kids' families' homes. A child can feel scared, abandoned. Many children are furious? What do we do with all those emotions?
Well, I think, first of all, and it's been touched on, I think we have to help children name those emotions. They're often not able to really put a label on that. We help very small children really understand a wide gamut of emotions, anything from happiness, joyfulness, anger, shame, all of those things, helping them know what that is, what does that feel like, how do they express it appropriately is very important. But I also think that going beyond just learning about the feelings, helping them understand they're not alone, that there are many children, in fact, one in four families are dealing with someone in the family that's addicted, and helping them have a sense of that they can turn to others and ask for help. I often see children who come to our programs who have never talked about it before, and they don't think anyone knows or that anyone can have a sense of what they've experienced. And when you see that child look across the table to another child when they're speaking and you can see that connection that's being made, that's really important. And that gives them a sense of freedom to go to another trusted adult and build those resiliency factors and those supports that are needed to move on in a positive way.
Yeah, being with kindred spirits really does change everything. But listen, I'm having a problem with you three experts here. So you're talking about all this understanding and ways of getting children to understand alcoholism. But, you know, here we are looking at a parent who looks healthy and is behaving horribly. And you're asking a child to understand that. Spouses don't understand it. We as a culture don't understand it. We label it, but they're still pariahs. So you're loading a lot on little kids. I'll turn to you first, Carolyn.
Well, I think it's important to use the child's own behavior to help him understand. Like I did in the book, I talk about Tommy has an issue with his Halloween candy and his mom.
I want to back you up, though, because before that, you said that it was an allergy, or mom said that it was an allergy. And Tommy said, yeah, I get that, but I've got a peanut allergy, and I just stopped eating peanuts. Just that simple. So that went down the toilet.
Yes, yeah, well.
With all due respect.
I guess he could. That's a little bit, it was kind of the entrance into understanding that this is a physical thing that is not controllable, and if you eat the peanut or have the drink, you're kind of going to go down the tubes that way. And I think that that's kind of in the beginning of the book when Tommy doesn't really understand what's going on yet until he gets to the candy episode.
I'll let you off the hook. So tell us about the candy episode.
Well, after trick-or-treating, he comes home and he asks his mom if he can have some candy, and she limits him to two or three pieces. And he does that, but with some hemming and hawing, goes to bed. But in the middle of the night, he sneaks down with his dog, and they indulge in lots and lots of candy. And she uses that episode, the mother uses the episode, to help him understand that sometimes what you want and what your impulses are so strong that you behave badly. You make bad choices, and you know, you're kind of not in your best mode.
Yeah, I thought that was wonderful. I thought it was wonderful.
Oh,
and
that's great.
And I should say something nice to you after I just tormented you. Screwing something up. But I want to hear from both of you. Kim and Tammy, and I'll turn to you, Tammy. Aren't we asking too much of our children to ask them to, quote, understand all this aberrant behavior in someone that looks healthy?
I think we are in some ways. I think there's such a loss of childhood at this time. And, you know, a lot of the work that we end up doing, we have a camp that we run. And certainly we balance out the educational pieces. We want them to have as much information as they can, that we can provide. But we also, I think we're asking a whole lot, and I think it's a gradual process. It takes a lot of patience, but sometimes we need to kind of get back to the basics. These children often don't know how to play or have fun, the basics of childhood, and allowing them to do that is very important as well.
Yeah, and there's not much fun in these families, is there?
Well, and they often have to play a much more adult role than you would expect for, say, an 8-year-old. I've worked with children who have had to make dinner at very young ages. They are really exhausted by taking care of younger siblings when the parents are overwhelmed with the challenges and conflict of the addiction in the family. And that is, I think, asking too much. And I think these children do need to have a sense of that they need to control, take care of themselves and control what they can control. And so kind of getting back to the basics of what is reasonable, and that helping them communicate what they need from their families and from the adults in their life is very important.
There's a flip side of this also, and Kim, I want to turn to you. I know with other kinds of disabilities in the family, kids might be harmed, they might be burdened, but they also grow up being more resilient and have a larger world view. They're more compassionate and understanding of others. Can that happen in these families also?
Yes, excuse me. Yes, it can. And, you know, a lot of it has to do with the closeness and the amount of stability that is provided by the other parent in the family, or if there's, or, you know, other member of the family. If it's not necessarily a parent, it could be a grandparent or an aunt or uncle. And I don't know, it's actually very complicated, a lot of interacting factors, but it does seem that providing stability and having an open, connected relationship with the other parent can help to mitigate.
Depending on the behavior of the other parent.
Yes.
Yeah.
Dan, I also wanted to say something about the understanding. I really don't think understanding is what we're asking the kids to do. I think that what was happening in Carolyn's book was really sort of taking opportunities to help the child be more accepting. So when talking about the allergy, it's not that you want to understand the addiction as an allergy. It's allowing Tommy to connect with his experience, with his dad's experience. So we're talking about understanding. I really don't think that we really expect the children to come out with a really good understanding of addiction. I think it's more acceptance.
That makes sense. Let's go to the phones. We've got people who want to join the conversation. We'll start with Tim. We have Tim. Hi, Tim.
How are you?
I'm good. How about you, Tim?
I'm hanging in there. I just had a question, I guess relating more towards adult children of alcoholics. My father was an alcoholic throughout my life. He passed, 8 years ago. And then I was an alcoholic, been sober 5 years. And what I struggle with most as a 30-year-old adult is that intimacy with, romantic relationships and having that kind of trust. And I don't know, I've read Adult Children of Alcoholics, but, you know, this has been something I continue to struggle with in terms of, you know, that kind of trust. And I guess it would help to let you know that I'm a gay man. So being my father, I don't know if that has a more compounding effect in terms of those issues for me.
I'll have my experts here talk about issues of intimacy and trust, and you're certainly not alone. I'm sure you know that. But let me just ask you a simple question when it comes to intimacy and trust. What are you scared of, Tim?
I guess, you know, the being let down when you confide in someone, especially, I guess, a parent who is someone you should be able to rely on and trust, and then only to have them disappoint you. And I don't know if that manifests itself in partners more readily than friendships, because my friendships seem to be stronger, but I have a harder time, you know, taking that next step with, stronger relationship.
All right, let me come back then. We're going to... I understand your story, your explanations about why, and the explanations may very well be right. But I want to come back to my question. What are you afraid of? Stay with it.
I don't know. I don't know if it's being myself completely or what. I don't know if it's a self-acceptance thing or, you know, because it can't be the other person. It's something within me.
Of course it is. Here's the deal, Tim. That fear in you that doesn't have a face, that you haven't identified, that you may or may not have even experienced fully, that fear is driving your life. And you haven't even been introduced to it yet. That's the question for you. What are you afraid of? And the more you can know that, the more you can experience it, it's not going to go away, but you'll be less afraid of it. You'll be able to manage it better. You know, it's...
Would you recommend, you know, a therapist or, you know, the AA thing was not as helpful for me.
Yeah, we'll talk off the air.
Sure.
Or you can find my email address online. I'm easy to find. And I'll recommend someone, but you have to do something first. One of the steps in AA has the phrase became willing. You have to become willing to dive into that, to face that. You'll learn the tools. The tools are available. Became willing. Okay?
All right. Thank you.
All right. I'll talk to you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
So I kind of took this call. I'm sorry I took the caller away from all you guys. But I do, before we take our break, we do have to talk about this issue of intimacy and trust. It's almost universal. I'll turn to you first, Carolyn.
Well, I think a lot of it has to do with how you interpret things as a child when you have an alcoholic parent and you feel that their behavior is because of you, that it's so connected that they're letting you down because you weren't good enough or loving enough or there was something wrong with you. Then you grow up and you feel that everything that you put out there and the way people respond to you is totally because of you and who you are. And like Tim was saying on the phone, I think that if he focused on his being trustworthy and forthcoming and open and connected to his partner rather than focusing on what he's going to get back. Because what he gets back isn't about him. That's right. About his partner, not
him. Well, and it's also the assumption we all make that whatever we get back, if the worst happens, that we won't be able to cope with it. I mean, right. Of course we'll be able to cope with it. All right, I'm getting pressure from the folks over in the engineer's room to take a break, so I shall. You never want to make a producer mad at you. Terrible things could happen. We're gonna take a short break. I'm talking with Carolyn Hannon Bell. She's a therapist in South Jersey. She's written Daddy's Disease, Helping Children Understand Alcoholism. Kim Kirby is the director of the Treatment Research Institute's Parents Translational Research Center. She's a senior therapist there. Tammy Granger's on the phone. She's a corporate director of student assistant programs at the Karen Treatment Centers. And our number is 888-477-9499. We're going to take many more calls after the break. But it's 888-477-9499. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY-FM.
Keystone Clinical Studies of Norristown is conducting a clinical research trial for adults who suffer from major depressive disorder. If you are between 18 and 65 suffering from major depressive disorder, and if your current medication is not working, you may be eligible to participate in this clinical research trial. Participants will receive investigational drug and study-related evaluations. 610-277-8073, 610-277-8073, or KeystoneClinicalStudies.com. Keystone Clinical Studies supports WHYY.
Devereaux is a proud supporter of WHYY. For more than 100 years, Devereaux has provided care to individuals with developmental disabilities and mental and behavioral health disorders. Devereaux's work also includes its full continuum of autism-specific programming for individuals of all ages, including residential services, community-based group homes, employment training, and support and educational programs. For more information on Devereaux's autism-specific services, devereaux.org.
We're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about what to tell children when there's an active alcoholic parent or even a recovering alcoholic parent. What do we tell them? How do we tell them? Our number is 888-477-9499. Kim, I want to start with you. What does this conversation look like? You know, I hear the number seven. You know, Tammy's camp starts with seven-year-olds. Your book, Carolyn, was this, I keep hearing this number. So what do we tell kids, and how do we tell them?
Well, you're bringing up the point of the child's age. I think what you're going to tell a child is going to be somewhat dependent on how old they are and how much they're really interested in hearing. It's probably a factor of having the Parents Translational Research Center. What we try to do is build.
What is that?
It is a grant that's funded by the National Institute on Drug Abuse. And the goal of the center is actually to help parents who have drug using children. Hmm. But one of the things we do in that center is develop practical tools for parents. And so what I did is I went through Carolyn's book and I extracted the rules for parents.
Hmm.
So one of the rules is that you don't talk, you do have to talk about the problem. Don't push it under the rug. Carolyn already mentioned that. Another thing that I saw in the book, and I think is really important, is that the parent who has not got the alcohol problem really needs to learn to regulate their own feelings about that person, especially when they're interacting
with
their child.
Easier said than done.
Much easier said than done. Certainly don't try to work it out in front of the child or through the child.
Al-Anon? You recommend Al-Anon?
Al-Anon is a good place to do it. Family therapy is a place to do it, even if you are going in without your spouse.
And or individual.
Individual therapy is a good place to do it as well. Mm-hmm. So one of the things I was really impressed about is that the parent in Carolyn's book never badmouths the father.
Critical.
Very, very important. She also chooses the time to talk, which I would say is like another rule, making sure that the child is able to receive the message at the time that she starts talking about it. The other thing I really liked is that there's one point where Tommy asks her a question, and she pauses and thinks. And I think that's a very important thing, to realize that if your child asks you a question, it's okay to take a second to think about how you're going to respond to that. And then there's sort of the basics of the message, and that is to emphasize that the problem is nobody's fault, and especially not the child's fault, and that the child cannot control or fix it. And we've talked about that a lot. The other thing that's apparent in Carolyn's book is the parent comes back to that multiple times. So I think it's important that parents need to realize they're going to have to probably repeat that message many times before the child is able to accept it. She reminded Tommy of times that he had positive with his father, which I think is really good, and talked a lot about his father. Your father loves you no matter what he does. So I think those are very good messages to be giving children. And in addition to waiting for seeing signs where Tommy was no longer really interested in talking about this and respecting that and stopping, it was the issue of looking for teachable moments. So the candy at Halloween was one of those examples.
That's good parenting 101, mm-hmm. whether there's substance abuse or not.
Absolutely.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got Chris on the line. Hi, Chris.
Hi. Hi, how are you today?
What can we do for you?
Okay, I just had a quick question. I am in recovery myself. I actually consider myself recovered. I know some people claim there's a difference. So, but my children never really saw me drink, but they certainly saw the outcome of it with our family life. I'm ended up divorced and all these things. But my question is, now children who seek help, young children who do get help with this and with a supportive, you know, my ex is very supportive, but get help. Do they seem to have a better psychological recovery rate when they have a parent who is in recovery, or is it the same or is it worse? I'm very curious, purely because when my children asked, you know, they never saw me drink, but they saw me, you know, not able to get up most mornings, not able to function. Now they ask me, why, Daddy, why don't you drink anymore? And I very clearly tell them, you know, because they're young, I'm like, well, you know, we like going out and doing things, you know, during on the weekends. We like to go do these fun things you know, understand that if when I drink, I'm not able to do those things with you. I might not be able to do those things. So I was wondering what the recovery rate would be is for children.
Good question. I'm going to turn to the researcher on that. Kim?
You know, I'm embarrassed to admit I do not know the research on that particular issue. My guess would be that the more help that the child gets, the better off they're going to be. And I do know that there's a lot of research showing a number of factors that do mitigate the problem of the substance use.
Like?
Well, I had mentioned close relationships. That's a very important one. Also, the fact, that, by the way, that you did not drink in front of your children is actually a factor that reduces the chance that they would develop substance use problems themselves. Mm-hmm. So that's a really good thing.
I'd love to add in if I could.
Yeah, Tammy, go.
One of the things I think is really important, especially with adolescents, we talked a lot about the younger child, but we also work with adolescents and teens. And I would say that students who get a better understanding of addiction at that particular age and understand it as really a family disease have a better understanding of the risk factors. I think that's very important as they're beginning to think about experimentation on their own. And we do know that if we can delay use to certainly after age 21, we know that addiction rates decrease. So we really arm students with a toolkit of, you know, what are the risk factors? How can they prevent this disease in their own life? Of course, it's not if they don't use, they will not become addicted. And so certainly we see higher rates of non-addicted individuals from families with addiction when they have education, when they have high awareness, and understand the continuum of addiction, they tend to either use at lower rates and also seek help at an earlier time for early intervention if there is a problem.
Yeah, I also wonder here about the genetics. I've got a young, early adolescent that I'm working with. Both of his parents are in recovery, and he never saw them drink. They were in recovery before he was born. So he never saw, but he sees them not drink, and they both told him that they don't drink because they have an allergy, like Carolyn talked about in her book. So he said to me, and he couldn't bring this up with his parents, he said, if they both have an allergy, am I going to have the same allergy? And what's going to happen if I were to try a drink? And, you know, it's not reasonable to tell him to never try a drink because he's always going to be curious. So I said to him, because I wasn't armed with the information you three are giving me now, I said to him, well, yeah, I mean there is a risk there that, you know, if both your parents are addicted, that you will be also. And you know, I told him about drinking the same way I talk to kids about sex. I, you know, the good news and the bad news. And I said, if you try it, you might feel really good at first, but, you know, you might want more. If you've got the addiction, you might want more and more. But these kids are curious. And is it realistic to hope kids don't drink until they're 21? Carolyn?
I think it's very unrealistic to think that they won't try it. And I think the more they're educated and they understand about alcoholism, the better a chance that they won't have problems in their own lives.
Yeah, that's true. Let's go back to the phones here. Let's go to Kelly on line 2. Hi, Kelly.
Hello. How are you guys doing today?
Good.
Well, what I just wanted to comment on was how important an Alateen group was for me when I was growing up. I'm going to be two generations of alcoholics before me, and I did not want to go to Alateen when I was young. But after I was gone for a while, I found how valuable it was, and I can see that now, especially that I'm in my late 20s, how important that safe space was for me with other kids who knew exactly what I was going through. And along with that, one of the things that my mom always told me, and the same thing, was that I have a gene, and I don't know if that gene's going to be active or not, she said, but you need to be aware of it, that if you choose to pick up the drink, you might end up not being able to control yourself.
Have you ever had a drink, Kelly?
I'm one of those people who waited until I was of legal age, and I'm not interested in it, honestly, and a lot of that was out of fear. But I ended up having an eating disorder that I lived with for 10 years. So it didn't manifest itself in alcoholism, but it manifested itself in another way, and I needed to be aware of that.
Yeah, exactly. I wonder what it was like, Kelly, growing up in an alcoholic family. What was it like for you? We're talking about kids who were 7, 8, 9 years old. Tell us Kelly.
As a little kid, you notice that some things are wrong, that you don't know how to put a name on it. And I think that was one of the things that Alateen and Al-Anon really brought to our family, was there was a name for it, and it was alcoholism. And then you start to see those things and realize, you know, this isn't a healthy way to live. There's a way that we can help ourselves and, you know, rebuild our family.
You're talking about just what we've been talking about. It's the non-alcoholic parent. Is really the linchpin here. So tell us about Al-Anon. What is this thing called Al-Anon, and what did it do for you?
Well, I was, I guess, in either late middle school or early high school when I started going to Alateen. Excuse me. And then my group was, you know, for children of active and recovering alcoholics. And it was just a group that was led by a couple of adult Al-Anon members, and I don't like to use the word led because it wasn't really led, but facilitated, where they would, you know, lead us through some activities and give us a safe spot to talk about different topics that were going on in our lives and what our experience was like living in these families and how we could, excuse me, steel ourselves against the insanity that we saw and just gave ourselves, you know, a group of like-minded people who needed a place to feel safe together.
Yeah, that really is the deal, isn't it? Like-minded people where we could feel safe together. Thanks so much for your call, Kelly.
And thank you.
And the instruction. I mean, there's the expert there. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, I've got lots more we're going to talk about, and I want to hear from callers too. We'll take some calls in the final segment of our show. We're talking with Tammy Granger. She's Corporate Director of Student Assistant Programs with Karen Treatment Centers. Kim Kirby is with the Treatment Research Institute, where she's a senior scientist there. And Carolyn Hannon Bell wrote Daddy's Disease, Helping Children Understand Alcoholism. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. If there's alcoholism in your family, or if you grew up with alcoholism, give us a call. We'd love to hear from you. Again, 888-477-9499. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY-FM.
Independence Blue Cross is proud to support WHYY. The new healthcare law is here, and Independence Blue Cross can help consumers understand how the new law affects individuals and families. Independence Blue Cross has been here for 75 years, and they're committed to being here for whatever lies ahead. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless. To find out more about how the healthcare law could affect you, details at ibx.com.
Devereaux is a proud supporter of WHYY. For more than 100 years, Devereaux has provided care to individuals with developmental disabilities and mental and behavioral health disorders. Devereaux's work also includes its full continuum of autism-specific programming for individuals of all ages, including residential services, community-based group homes, employment training, and support and educational programs. For more information on Devereaux's autism-specific services, devereaux.org.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about alcoholism in the family, specifically when a parent is alcoholic, what to tell the children and how, and what these kids are living with. How can we help? We're talking with Carolyn Hannon Bell, Kim Kirby, and Tammy Granger. Let's go right to the phones. We've got Suzanne on line four there. Hi, Suzanne.
Hi, Dan. How are you?
I'm good. How about you?
What I told the screener is that I'm the daughter of an alcoholic, sober myself 35 years, and a psychologist, and have worked a lot in the field over the years. And my comment is really how fortunate for any family where there is one parent who is addressing this directly. That was not the case in my family, where my mother was in complete denial and an enabler. And so the most troubling thing for my siblings and myself, I'm one of eight children, was that reality was completely up for grabs, because this was going on, but nobody was talking about it. And that is unbelievably damaging. So if there is one parent who is willing to talk to the child, I think the fine-tuning and the nuancing is terrific, but I would say that those children are way ahead of the game.
Yeah, and I agree with you, Suzanne. Obviously, the three of us agree. But I want to talk about with the guests how we can help a parent. You know, Suzanne used the word enabling, and, you know, it sure sounds like it. I know you've got feelings about that word, Kim, and you wrote an article about it. But, you know, how do we help a parent who is living in such chaos? Mm-hmm. You know, it takes courage to be honest with the kid. It takes more courage to be honest with yourself.
Yes, you're right. Let's see. I guess the first thing I'd like to say about that is I think it's important for parents to know that the children know something's going on, whether you say something about it or not. So it's not like, I think a lot of parents think they're keeping a secret. You are not keeping a secret. The children know. And what you can do by talking to them is make something that's vague and amorphous a little bit clearer to them. So that's one thing I'd say. I do have feelings about the word enabling. And the reason I have feelings about it is because I think it helps us to blame the family members that are dealing with the problem.
Mm.
And we have, one of my areas of research is really dealing with families who are dealing with addiction. And I've done a lot of work with parents and spouses who are dealing with this problem. So I've seen a lot of families, and I can't say that, you know, there's any of them that looked to me like they started out necessarily with some huge problem. I mean, there is the historical issue, so people sometimes are dealing with things that have rolled on from generation to generation. But every family I've met cares about their family members. They are doing the best that they know how to do. And so I think that's important to understand, that even if your parent has messed up, they were doing the best that they could do, and that the best that they knew how to do. So in terms of what can parents do about it, I think it's get more educated. I do think that a lot of parents find help and support in Al-Anon, Nar-Anon, or other kinds of parent support groups. You know, if things are really problematic, consider therapy.
We need that. Parents need that badly. I remember when I was a caregiver, and you know, I was running around doing what caregivers do, and somebody said, "How are you, Dan?" And you know, I went on to talk about, you know, at the time it was my wife who was very ill, and you know, I talked about her, I talked about the kids, and she said, "No, Dan, how are you?" Mm-hmm. And I just began to sob, I just began to cry. I couldn't realize how tired I was, how scared I was. So
I'm glad,
that's the question.
I'm glad you drew that parallel, because the family members of substance users are caretakers. They're taking care of somebody with an illness. And usually when we think about caregivers, we don't include the family members of substance users. But it's absolutely true. You need the same support as other people that are helping someone deal with a chronic illness.
Yeah. Tammy, what are you doing out in Karen?
Well, Karen Treatment Centers is primarily a treatment center, residential treatment center for the individual. However, I'm really proud of the work we've been doing and have the philosophy that we need to treat the whole family. So for every primary program, we have a family education program, and that lasts for several days. Most families come up for about 5 days of treatment, and it really does break down key information, discusses enabling, and helps them begin to heal. The one program we also offer is a children's program, and that is for the younger child to come up for a day to learn more. And this is very helpful as a patient's in treatment, that there's an educational component and a healing component for each individual family member, and that can continue to be built as they go home and begin the recovery process. I think the one thing that's sometimes not discussed, you know, we're talking a lot about what's the experience like for a child who's living with an active family, active addiction in the family. But when recovery begins, that is also really traumatic for children.
How so?
It can be very confusing, especially the concept of relapse. So they've had this experience and confusion and probably inconsistencies in the family, and that maybe have gone on for a long period of time. And now their parent leaves and goes to, let's say, into treatment, and they can be gone a long time. And I think there's a lot of mixed feelings there. While some of the problems have been reduced, but wondering, is mom and dad coming home? What's it going to be like when they come home? Are things going to go back to normal? And I think that those are some key times that we have to continue to support that child and help them go through that process and bring them closer to more understanding and readiness to really have recovery as an entire family.
You make a wonderful point there about the issue of relapse and essentially any chronic disease. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Alan on the line.
Hi there. Hey. I'm a person in long-term recovery. I've been sober for 30 years. I have a son who's in recovery 15, and a brother who just passed away who had 10 years of recovery. And we share one thing in common, and that is one day your parent is functional, and then the progression takes hold, and sooner or later the parent ceases to be functional, and that's very disturbing for a child. And what happens is the child looks at the other parent for help. The other parent doesn't know how to do that, and you go off on your own to become an adult much sooner than you need to be, and without any direction. So I'd like to hear what your panel has to say about that.
I'm not done with you, young man. Are you there?
Yes.
Yeah, you're not going away so fast. So I want to know, as a child, when they relapsed, what was it like for you? And more important, Alan, what did you need as a child in those moments?
Well, first of all, there was no relapse. It was just continuous use, and my mother finally died of her addiction and related cancer. What I needed was a mother, I guess. I saw other kids with a mom and normal families, and I saw that I didn't have one, and I was embarrassed to bring kids home to my house. And my father just sat there in abject silence, you know. And here we were, kids, and wondering what's going on here, you know. You follow me?
I do very well. One last quick question, then I'm going to turn to my guests. How are you? How's your life now?
Oh, my life is beautiful now. I'm in recovery. Got a great home, and
great.
I've reconciled with my children, and
wonderful.
It's just fabulous. And I did attend the Karen Family Program, by the way. I went to rehab elsewhere, but
that was an excellent
program.
Are you a plant here from the Karen Foundation?
No, I'm not. I'm just a guy in recovery listening to all of
Alan,
I never hear this subject on the radio.
You're right. Thanks so much for your call. I really appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. That really is a whole different issue. Tammy, since you got the plug, you follow up. Let's get in our closing minute, how do we help children cope with progressive diseases?
Well, I think in general, we continue to have support for them available through obviously reaching out to professionals as needed, helping parents do the best they can, letting children know that in this process, love is usually right there behind any challenge, and you know that there's a lot of hope and healing available to them, and there's a lot of promise for the kids who are growing up in these families, as long as there's some support and an openness to get them some assistance.
Hmm. Well, thank you, and thank you for joining us, Tammy Granger. She's from Karen Foundation. Kim, thank you. She's with the Treatment Research Institute, and she's a senior scientist there. Carolyn, thank you. Carolyn wrote a great book called Daddy's Disease, Helping Children Understand Addiction. I want to, before we close, I've got a personal note here about the death of Nelson Mandela. I was in Africa this past summer, South Africa, and I was experiencing as his life was winding down and how people just adored this man and were so grateful to him. I saw the shadows of apartheid that continue for people who were 30 and 40 years old and older. And I saw hope and change evolve, all as a result of this one man. I was deeply hurt, deeply saddened. It was a personal loss for me, and I think for the world. And I wish I was in South Africa right now, sitting Shiva with the rest of the country. Well, again, thank you for listening today. To download podcasts of our shows, we're at whyy.org/voices. You can follow us on Twitter. We're at Voices in the Fam. And you can reach me at drdangottlieb.com. The engineer for today's show has been Adam Staniszewski. Thanks, Adam. Elizabeth Perez-Loon is our executive producer of audio content. Emily Haas is our production assistant. Mike and Scott is our executive producer. Jennifer Lynn is not only our producer, but answered the phones today. She does it all. Me, I'm Dan Gottlieb. Hey, please enjoy your week, my friends.